Hey, this is David Hayter. You may know me as the screenwriter of films like X-Men, X-Men 2, and Watchmen, but you probably know me best as the voice of Solid Snake from Metal Gear Solid. And you're listening to Hawaii's number one podcast, the Casanova Podcast. Kept you waiting, huh?
This wasn't written with your comfort in mind.
Nah.
Made my decision, wasn't tough to decide. Nah. Me and my boys, we get it done every time. Gotta earn it, you can't just jump in the line. You'll get rushed to the side. I top my division, I've been building since I started. In the parking lot, I parked it. I came in while picking targets. My career cannot be tarnished. I'm a champion regardless. Celebrate, but there's a different kind of lucha party. We are not alike.
I don't want your advice, I don't want your opinions. It's not gonna be different from the ones I told to listen. I've been working on a bigger picture and y'all ain't impressing me. Hey, como se dice, shut your mouth, respect the legacy. Ain't no comparisons, y'all just embarrassments. All of my confidence is rooted in my heritage. Yo, and with Mendoza and Mr. Wild, we showing what this about. Phantom driving, your career is disavowed. What's happening, y'all?
Hello, everyone. It's Mikhail Casanova, host of the Casanova Podcast, number one podcast in Hawaii. And today I've got a very, very special guest, the one, the only, Ains. What's up, man?
What's happening, Mikhail? How you doing, man? Good to be here.
Doing good, doing good. You know, Christmas is right there.
Yeah, we're just before.
I think I got all my shopping done. I think
so. Yeah, I honestly got home about an hour ago. I'm still running around, so yeah.
So, man, how's everything going? How's, you know, gaming and work and everything like that?
Yeah, not too bad, man. My career work is a little crazy. I'm in, without going into too many specifics, I'm in like application development. So I work in speech recognition, working with generative AI now and, you know, robotics and all that kind of stuff. So that's very busy. But other than that, it's good, man. Season gaming's done really well this year and had a great year with the crew. And yeah, man, now just trying to take a little bit of a break, you know, over the next couple of weeks through the holidays before we get back into it in 2024. You know how it is. So
yes, you know what's crazy is you probably feel the same way, but this has been an insane year for gaming.
Ridiculous
tech.
Yeah,
like it felt like from the minute January hit till now, like it has not let off the gas. Like, I feel like other week something has come out, and I'm trying to remember when the last time we had a year this stacked.
Like, yeah, I don't think we have. I know I talked about it with the crew over at SG, and it was like, have we seen a year like this? And we kind of went back through, and 2007 was looked at as an incredible year, and it was. And 2017, 18, you know, there's some incredible gaming years out there. But if you look all up, in terms of just releases, I think this year is it, man. It's been nuts, no doubt.
Yep. Did you ever get to a point where you felt like, hey, I need a break?
Yeah. And in fact, like, I did. So we do reviews and everything at the site, and the crew, kind of pretty solid crew right now, which is amazing. And it, you know, for your listeners, like, we're an independent site, we're non-monetized, like, we literally just do it because we love gaming. And despite that, we went through yesterday, actually, we were talking about this. We did 50 reviews this year. So, you know, we're averaging like one a week, basically, of major titles and stuff. I think I did 10 myself. And that's, you know, trying to play all the other games that are releasing, too. I have so many games that have come out that I haven't finished. You know, I put like 10 hours into it, and then you jump to the next one and jump to the next one. And it's just like, you know, I've played all these games, but I haven't finished hardly any of them. And it's daunting, to be honest.
Yeah, and people don't understand it. Like, it really gets difficult, especially when you have like outside work and you have family, if you have kids.
Yes.
And like, people are like, oh, well, you're going to cover this, you're going to cover that. Like, I'm doing my best.
There's only so much time in a day. Yeah. It's a lot. I know you've probably talked about this a lot too, but you know, I talk with some of the guys on the regular about just like content creation and how it's evolved, how it's changed, and expectations of delivery, right? Because there's so many people doing it now, and it's just like, it's, for people who don't do it, the time and the effort and the things that go on behind the scenes that you may not be aware of, it's just, it's exhausting and time consuming, and it's a lot. It's a lot. Yeah.
Yeah. It's, you know, I've been trying to explain that to, you know, not only my audience, but like family. I think the biggest one is like family, like outside of my wife and my kids, like my immediate family, they don't get it. Like my mom and siblings and all that. They're like, oh yeah, you're just playing on the internet. You just
like, games for a living. Yeah.
Yeah. You're just writing on a blog. I'm like, you have no idea, especially when you start working with companies and brands and all that. And then all the NDAs and everything like that. There's so much. It's so overwhelming. It's exhausting. And then you got to maintain yourself, like your fitness, you know, your lifestyle, everything. Like it's super overwhelming. And I don't know if you feel this way as well, but I feel like trying to maintain social media on top of all that. Mm-hmm. Like I've gotten to a point, like I'm barely posting on social media because I'm like, I'm too tired.
Yeah.
And I know I need to, but it's like, I feel like the algorithm for with Twitter or X and all these platforms, they keep changing. It's like,
yes,
use hashtags, don't use hashtags. You know, you need to put a picture in there. Don't just put a link. And I'm like, I don't have, especially chasing a 2-year-old around. I'm like, how do you guys keep up with that?
Yeah. Yeah. It's too much, man. And you add social media, you add all these new platforms and new ways of doing things to your point. It's just, it's too much. I'm fortunate to the point now where my kids, so my wife and I had kids younger. And so my kids are now grown up, and I'm older. So my kids are now grown up. My youngest is 18.
What are you talking about? You know, David, so, 20.
Fortunately, the post work time in the evening is a little more open than it used to be. But even then, man, it's still tough. And then, yeah, adding kids, I'd say several of the guys who write for my site have younger kids and stuff. And it's just, you know how it is. It's nonstop. Yeah. And trying to find time to do it all is very tough. Yeah,
definitely. So let's hop into DeLorean. Let's go back and let's start with you, like your earliest memory of gaming, how you discovered your love and passion for it, and then let's go on that journey. The floor is yours. Don't leave anything out, even the boring parts.
Don't leave anything out. Wow, we're gonna be here a long time. So I'm in my mid-40s. Started gaming in the beginning of the 80s when I was very little. So one of the earliest memories I have is playing the Atari 2600 with my brother. Now, my brother is 9 years older than me. So he was, young teen, I guess, at the time, or just about to be. But playing Yar's Revenge on the Atari 2600 and some of those games. And then my dad used to take me to the arcade when I was super little. I used to get the stool so I could reach the controls, and I would play like Star Wars and Missile Command, I remember, in the arcade, which I think was like 81. So I mean, you're going way back. But yeah, playing those games. And then I just remember always being fascinated by video games. Like as soon as I got my hands on a controller and I was controlling something on the screen, I loved it. And from there, of course, you go through the Atari days and you get into when the NES comes out, in the US in 85, I believe it was. And that kind of blew people away. And I still remember by that point, my mom and my dad had split. So I was with my mom. She didn't have any money, so we couldn't afford a video game system. But I went to my friends who just got the Nintendo with Super Mario. And I remember first seeing and playing that, and we stayed up all night playing it, just mesmerized, by that game, which I think it did to a bunch of children, back then. and then just loved it from there, man. Became a Sega kid. So I got a Sega Master System and, later a Genesis. And since that point all the way through my teens into my 20s and into my early 30s, I basically began collecting and competing. So I wanted to own as many systems and games as I could. So I, even obscure things. So I became a Neo Geo collector, and I was part of a big Neo Geo collecting group. And I used to buy and sell games on eBay when eBay first came out. you know, when you used to mail money orders to people. So you would send a money order to someone and then wait for the game to come back weeks later. you know, had a huge collection of different kind of rare games, Japanese stuff and Neo Geo and 3DO and TGI, you know, all those kind of obscure systems that I just loved goofing off with. And then I got into competitive gaming as well. So I at a couple points in my lives, I played competitive Street Fighter 2 and Mortal Kombat 1 and 2. And then when Halo came out, so you get into 2001 and, you know, I grew up playing PC shooters, Doom and all those through the 90s. Mm-hmm. And then Xbox came out 2001 and I played Halo, and Halo kind of just took me aback. I fell instantly in love with Halo. And I began that's probably my favorite gaming IP. I played competitive Halo 1 and 2 in tournaments. And still play online competitive today, not, you know, as seriously as I once did. I'm too old to be that good anymore, but still love it. And anyway, I kind of jumped around a bit. But yeah, I mean, essentially my entire life since 3-4 years old when I first got my hands on a controller, I've loved gaming. And I've spent, outside of a few years, maybe in my early 20s, where the focus was cars and girls for the most part, you know, it's been my number one passion for sure. And I still, to this day, I don't collect, you know, physical games are a little different nowadays. But I collect collectibles. So I'm sitting in my gaming room. So I have an entire floor of my house, which is my gaming room. And I have, you know, dozens of the big gaming statues and collectibles, and the whole room is just gaming collectibles top to bottom. So awesome. Yeah.
So that leads me to want to ask you, how has it been seeing the evolution of gaming? I'm slightly younger than you. So like my first console was the NES, and then I was there for like the launch of the Super Nintendo and then going on from there. But like how, you know, starting with the Atari and, you know, arcades and to the NES and to where we are now, like how wild has it been seeing that jump? It's, I know, crazy. the generation now is not gonna, they're not gonna understand it because they haven't grown with it the way we have, but like go ahead, sorry,
no, you're spot on. I mean, I talk to my son about those things and I tell him of some of the things when I was younger, you know, and he just kind of laughs. Like, you can see him processing it and not really understanding it because conceptually he just hasn't lived in that era, right? Yeah, I'd say we're spoiled for choice nowadays. You know, there are so many games being created on a daily, weekly, monthly basis, and there's so many different ways to access them instantly for free. You know, all these different things that we're spoiled for choice. If, you know, if we had even a fraction of the games that come out today, you know, it would be a monumental release, you know, back in the day. So I think in many, many, many ways, gaming has vastly improved in the sense of you can play games anywhere on so many different devices. You and I could end this podcast, jump on and play a game together, whereas before I would have never known you or met you, you know what I mean? And I've met tons of friends through online gaming, you know, that have become lifelong friends in real life. And so I think all of those factors are really, really cool, and seeing the technology evolve and the kind of experiences that probably you and I, when the NES era, we never really envisioned, you know, gaming being on a pedestal above movies and above music, and just seeing what's being created nowadays, I think is fascinating. That said, there are a few things I do miss about the old school days of gaming. I think arcades are one. I really miss arcades. I love the arcade culture. I love the competitiveness. I love the camaraderie that you would have in the arcades. And seeing new games just show up in the arcade was like Christmas morning. Every time you walked in, you know, you see a new arcade cabinet and you're like, hey, and there went the rest of your allowance, you know what I mean? Or, you know, money. I miss that a lot. And I reminisce about that with some other people who are kind of our age, or, you know, around our age, I should say, about that quite a bit. The other thing is I do miss the ease of access. I think comes, it's great. And it's a net positive, but I do miss the days of going to a Toys R Us or going to a KB or, you know, whatever store it was, an EB Games or what have you, and just looking at the shelf and seeing all the games and, you know, looking at the box art and the and reading about them and, you know, seeing the new games arrive and talking to the people in the store, the employees, and just having that, again, camaraderie. It was a, I think the gaming culture now, because the industry is so vast and so big and everybody games, it has lost the niche feel that it had. You know, there was a point in time when we were young where if you were a gamer, if you and another person said, oh, you're a gamer, you were immediately bonded. You know what I mean? Exactly. You were immediately friends and you just got along. It was like, cool, what games do you play? And you'd share and play and talk about it. And that I think that we've lost that to a degree. And it's, you know, again, probably a net positive, but I do miss some aspects of that. I think that was really fun times when you would kind of had when gaming was more niche and everyone was kind of, you know, you accepted you were a geek at the time. Not that we're not now, but you accepted that you were a geek and you enjoyed it and kind of reveled in it with the other geeks and had a lot of fun doing so.
Yeah, it definitely seems like you said, with it becoming so widespread. And for those who may not understand the scope of how big gaming is, it's like the number one entertainment platform right now. Like it's above movies. It's above
by a lot
TV. It, like it's substantially like it's not at all small. I know people say, oh, games are for kids, which is such a weird thing to be hearing.
Such an outdated mentality. Yeah,
it really is. But it's like it's so monumentally huge that, you know, it's wild to think 20 years ago or 15 years ago, it was still kind of niche.
Yeah.
And if you really go back to like, you know, 80s and 90s, how like you had congressmen like Joseph Lieberman and whatnot trying to shut down combat because it was too like it was so crazy. I remember that from back in the day. But like it's wild, you know, and with it being mainstream, I feel like that also has helped and hurt it in many ways because like back then you're a gamer and like, oh, you like games too? Like, yeah, you had that camaraderie, you bonded. But now it's like, oh, you like game? What do you like? Are you, you know, like what do you play divisions. On? What do you it's crazy. And it's wild when you see like mobile gaming. A lot of people now like, oh, who cares about mobile gaming? I'm like, that's one of the biggest areas. It's
the biggest percentage.
Yeah.
Yep.
So
yeah. Yeah. It's so yeah, I think there's really good things and the technology won't slow down, right? If anything, it's speeding up. So we're going to see a bigger evolution of what games will become in the next decade plus and on, which I'm, you know, I'll continue to be fascinated by, but yeah, it's fun to reminisce about those days because to your first point there, like when I talk to my son about those things, he just, he can't understand it because he's never lived it. He's never his entire life. There's nothing that he can kind of relate to of that's even of that era. You know, he's since he's been young, he's had smartphones around and the internet and, you know, just the ability to play games anytime he wants. And, you know, it's just it's very, very different from how I grew up and, you know, our generation grew up.
And speaking of like, so for people to understand further the generational gap, like you look at smartphones now, you go back. When did the first iPhone came out? It came out 07, 8?
Something like that. Yeah, it's going, it's 13, 15 years, something like that.
So it's like, you look at like, the generation that's growing up now, or that's teenagers now, or young adults, they grew up with that being a present thing. I remember, like you, like, we remember back before we had smartphones. You know, back before internet was so widespread available. Back before social media, like I remember forum days, you know.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. I loved it. I was on gaming forums, and I remember in 96 or 97, I bought a PC and I financed it. PCs were expensive, and I didn't have much money. I was working at where the hell was I working? I don't know, some, you know, minimum wage job. and financed it. And I remember it buying a NIC card. And if you don't know what that is, it's a network interface controller, basically, and installing it, literally reading instructions on how to install it in my computer so I could play online. And of course, back then it was a phone line. So I, you know, to play Ultima Online, which was one of the first MMOs. Playing that. And then, of course, you know, I lived with my mom and my sister at the time. And, you know, my sister never been into this stuff or tech at all. And I would tell her, you can't pick up the phone. Like, I'm playing a game. Don't pick up the phone. And inevitably, you know, she'd pick up the phone. I'd get disconnected, like, mid-dungeon and yelling down the hallway, like, ah, what are you doing? You know, it's just those kind of stories. Like, they're all true. And you tell kids today, they're like, they have no idea what you're talking about. Zero.
Yeah. Remember funny. When gaming magazines used to be like the big thing? You go into a grocery store or Barnes & Noble, or man, that was so crazy. And it's like now.
I was going to say you probably have similar, but like I'd go with my mom to the grocery store, right? And I would go to the magazine section, just sit down, and as she got the groceries, and I just sit and read EGM or GamePro or you know, whatever. I can't even remember all of them nowadays, but you know, so fun.
Man, yeah. See that nostalgia, like, and it's so it's so rare for me. Like, okay, so most of the content creators I talk to are fairly. Many of them are a few that I actually talk to frequently are around our age. A lot of them are super young, and like their biggest gaming experience is like, oh yeah, the Xbox 360. And I'm like, oh, okay. Yeah. So yeah, taping that down a little bit. All right. Okay. Yeah. Well, I can talk about that era. Like, yeah, man, I was like in kindergarten. They're like, how old are you? I'm like, I was in college. But okay.
Yeah, they're like, the first Final Fantasy I played was Final Fantasy 10, and I'm like, oh, whoa, okay. Oh, all right.
That's like when people now, like, I know a lot of folks are hyped for, was it Final Fantasy Rebirth? And
you
can't talk about what happened in the original Final Fantasy 7 because that's deemed spoilers. And I'm like, the game from 25 years ago? We can't talk about that? Oh my god. Anyway, yeah, I got sidetracked there. But so let's talk about the creation of Season Gaming and BitCast.
Sure. So it's kind of a good segue, actually, because, you know, we're reminiscing about an era where, at least in our minds, you know, and maybe it wasn't as much, but it seemed to be that kind of more passionate just about gaming, less about, you know, especially with social media and modern sites and all that. You know how it goes with, you know, just clickbait and, you know, creating content specifically to get clicks. So we get to about... let's see, right around the Xbox One and PS4 launch, about 2012, 13.
Yeah.
And I'm very into cars in real life too. So I raced before and I own a few cars and stuff. And so I was on a car forum and I started a gaming sub forum on a car forum. And it kind of garnered a bigger audience and it got bigger and bigger. And I started kind of posting some early thoughts and kind of blog style stuff and reviews and stuff. And people are like, you know, you're really good at writing, you write really well. And, you know, I got some nice compliments and I was like, you know, it'd be kind of cool to kind of do something dedicated to gaming, especially because I didn't really like the direction at the time that sites were starting to go with tons of ads and articles, you know, the opinion articles that are just formulated to get a response, right? Yeah. Really no depth to them at all. And in my mind, you know, coming from what we just talked about, I was like, there's such a great culture to gaming and there's such a great history to gaming. Why are we talking about these ridiculous, superfluous topics when there's so many better things we could be discussing? Mm-hmm. So anyway, I started SG as in 2015, I founded it right at the end in December 2015. Didn't really do much in 2016, trying to just figure out what it wanted to be. It was a one-page blog. And I, you know, I had no contacts really, or I didn't have social media accounts, nothing. And so by 2017, kind of formulated a little better and started doing some very early reviews and articles and just writing stuff and garnered a little bit of an audience. I wrote a few articles about, I think, Xbox at the time that blew up just because I was talking. I have a good foundation in technology due to my career, and I've worked in the corporate scene with executives. And so I think I came into it kind of understanding the corporate business nature of what Xbox and Microsoft were doing more than most content creators, I would say. Yeah. And so I wrote about some of those things, and they blew up and got attention, and that kind of garnered me a little bit of an audience, which was nice. And so I was like, well, maybe there's something here. But basically what I found at SG is I didn't want to ever create content purely for clicks or to be kind of guided by that mentality. And so the tenets of Season Gaming really are that it's non-monetized, there's no ads on the site at all, and that anyone who comes and writes with me and does content on the site, they own all their work, so they can take it with them or go, what have you. But it's really just of that vein. So when people reach out about writing for the site, it's like, you know, I kind of look at the work because there's a level that I expect. But right. The understanding is, you know, there's no compensation. I'm very open about it right up front. But, you know, you own your work, and I'll happily kind of help you out along the way. So it's kind of this collective of content creators that are really just passionate about gaming, and really a lot of us have the same mentality about gaming, just being more mature about it, being focused on the topics of what's good in gaming, how the gaming community can come together, you know, having a certain level of quality. So if you read our reviews, for instance, our editor is literally a novel writer. Our stuff is very well written and formulated, you know, and we don't do controversial stuff, really. It's just not us. So that's where the season came from, is it's kind of, you know, aged, mature gaming. Yeah. And so that's really what it's become. And the great thing is, over the past 6+ years or whatever it's been, it's really grown. I mean, we're certainly not a giant site by any stretch of the imagination, a small independent site, but in terms of where we started and what I originally thought it could be, because when I first started saying, hey, I want to create a gaming site, but we're not going to make any money on it. And, you know, it's not going to have any ads, but I want people to write for it. But, you know, we're not going to write for clicks, but we want clicks. And it's like, they're, you know, they're contrasting ideas. Yeah. And I think, you know, certainly there's probably a cap to the level of growth you can achieve with that type of model. But the cap I thought it had, we've blown away. So we celebrated some cool milestones a couple months ago. I think we passed 10 million total visitors to the site since we launched. Nice. You know, we did 50 reviews this year. We're on Open Critic. And then the Bitcast kind of spawned in 2017. So it's going on 6 years now, which is crazy to think about. We're on episode 277. We just wrapped last week. And that was me and a good buddy of mine in real life who started that. Just if you go back and watch our early episodes, they're really bad, really bad. like most we of
always,
our,
we always say that though.
Most of, yeah, exactly. Our, you know, you go anytime you go back and look at early content, it's like oof. So he had to leave the site for some personal stuff in 2020, but it's evolved over the years, and now, you know, really good foundation. So it's a 4-person panel on Sunday mornings. We do a live show. Travis is a writer at IGN and does reviews over at IGN. Rick Hoag is a has his own channel, big channel, and he's a lawyer. So he talks about the legal aspects of games and cases and their acquisitions and stuff. And then Dan Rodriguez is a good friend of mine who has kind of been along the ride with SG along the way. And so BitCast has done really well as well. It's a fun show. So sorry, again, a little bit all over the place there. But it was born out of the idea that we were discussing, is that gaming should be a thing about camaraderie, and we should enjoy this, and we should celebrate it. And we should focus on the positives in gaming, not the silly nonsense you see on social media or YouTube a lot. And that's what we've done. And we've kind of stuck to that. I'm very proud of the fact that we've stuck to that. We haven't changed course. We haven't kind of gone down the road of saying, well, we could probably get more clicks if we just did this. And we haven't done that. We've just stuck to our ideals. And I've met some really good people on the way. And I want to say there's about 8 probably regular contributors like we have, you know, that trying to write for SG on a regular cadence right now, which is great. All good, very good people. And yeah, it's excellent, man. It's been a lot of fun. A lot of work, but a lot of fun.
Yeah, I mean, when you're when you go through the, you know, having a website, you know, hosting it, writing reviews, having, you know, a panel of writers along with you, then doing YouTube, doing a podcast, like I need the audience to understand right now, that's a lot of work.
A lot. Yeah. People ask me, they're like, how do you, because I've actually had people ask me, like, this is what you do, right? And I'm like, what do you mean? Like, this is what you do for work. And I'm like, no, like, no, this is a side thing. And it's like, oh, does it make you good money? I'm like, no, it costs me money. Like, I literally lose money on Season Gaming. I spend money to run it. And they're like, well, why do you do it? And I'm like, well, you know, I love it. Right. That's the whole point. I'm proud of that. It sounds ridiculous, I realize. But I am still proud of that. And it is a lot. It's one of those things where as we grew and I thought, okay, maybe I need to redesign the site and make it more like a full website, you know, and add pages and columns and everything. And I'm not a web designer. So, you know, I have literally figured it out along the way. I've done it all myself and just kind of experiment here and there and figure things out. And, you know, it's been a lot. And of course, as you get bigger and you have to host a site and host a channel mm-hmm. and do graphics and use software and, you know, the money to run it just keeps going up mm-hmm. and up and up and up every month, you know, and it's been a ride. That's for sure.
Yeah. That's one of the things, like, a lot of people assume like doing journalism or content creating, there's a lot of money in it, and it's really not. Like, I used to do for like over 14 years, I was doing IT, and I did setting up accounts. I did telephony. Then the last thing I did, I was doing InfoSec. So,
okay,
like doing that, I was like, I was making good money doing that, but I was also miserable because it's like,
sure,
when you're in IT, it's like everything is your fault. It's your problem. Yeah. You need to fix it. That's not even in my field. No, you need to fix it right now.
Yesterday.
Yeah. You know, so like I'm fortunate to be able to do content creating full time, but like more so in the sense of the money, you know, saved up from working IT, and then the little bit I get here, you know, I don't really have to take care of a whole lot. You know, I'm glad we own our property, the condo we have and everything like that. But like is there a lot of money in it? I mean, if you were clickbaiting, yeah. But at the same time, I think a lot of people don't understand. A lot of folks that clickbait or they're unhealthily on social media to find the trends, to keep up with it, it takes a toll. Like, I know a lot of successful, like, I'm sure you know a lot of super successful content creators that follow the trends, and they burn out.
Yeah, big time.
And it's just, you know, at one point I thought about doing that, but then I just saw too many people just miserable.
Yeah, exactly.
You know?
Yeah. It's a persona in a lot of ways. I talk to people about that. It's like that some of the people you see that are posting every 15 minutes and, you know, new video 4 days a week, and, you know, it's a persona. They're not happy. You know, they're doing it because it feels like it's what they have to do, and they've backed themselves into a corner. And that's exactly what I didn't want to do. You know, I kind of separate my career work over here. SG has limits because they're self-imposed limits, right? I could take it further. It could be bigger if I spent more time on it, but I maintain, you know, I've come to the realization, because there were, you know, I'm sure you've done this. There's points where it gets into your head like, damn, I need to do that. Maybe if I put more time here and do this, and you're constantly thinking and reevaluating. And a couple years ago, I want to say, so we had a big tragedy in my life five years ago, excuse me. And that made me reevaluate everything in life, top to bottom. But, you know, over the time, that has really helped keep me balanced to say, like, I started this as a fun thing, a genuine thing, and that's what it's going to be. It has limits because of that, and that's fine. You know, that's perfectly fine. Yeah.
And working with that too, like, it hasn't limited you in any way. I mean, you guys have covered so much on Season Gaming. Like, you've been able to do astronomical stuff. It's very inspiring, in my opinion. And it's one of those things where it's like, the misconception people have of you have to go over the top, or you got to be this large in life personality to be able to do the things that you think you want to do. And it's like, you really don't. If you can network, and of course, you know, you coming from, you know, a corporate background, understanding how to network and talk to people professionally, that opens a lot of doors.
And yeah, it does.
I think, especially now, you know, anyone who wants to get into journalism or content creating or just coverage in general, trying to work with brands and PR people now is substantially easier than I think it's ever been. You can literally reach out, you know, either, it's not tweeting anymore, but I'm just going to call it tweeting. You can tweet or, you know, whatever social media platform. Most of these, you know, companies, they have websites, they have a contact us form, or they got partner programs, or, you know, there's just so much out there that I think you don't have to, you know, you don't have to be this, I don't know, toxic internet personality.
Yeah. Yes, absolutely. Yeah. It's, and it's sad to see a lot of that. Right. And it's, it almost becomes challenging at times to stay away from it. Not in my own creation, but just seeing it constantly, you know, and, yeah, so it, that's an effort, but I think like people like yourself, like what we do at SG, and, you know, obviously a lot of the people I engage with, like, you know, there is a concerted effort to kind of put forth a better dialogue around gaming, from a more mature perspective, a more educated perspective, and to stay away from that kind of stuff. But, yeah, it is all over the place, and it's tough. And I think that goes back to what we were talking about too, with gaming being as large as it is now, and the environment we're in now with social media and content creation and YouTube and all these things, it just kind of, it spawns it, you know what I mean? And it's a shame, because it feels like at times, like it takes away from what we used to love and celebrate about gaming.
And that makes me want to ask the question. I know, very sensitive topic with leaks and everything that's been going on this year.
Yeah.
Do you see, because we see a lot of content creators jump at the bit to cover all these leaks come out and all this stuff. Do you think in the long run, it's doing more damage to the creator sphere by them doing that and causing companies to not want to trust creators and individual outlets, independent outlets?
Yeah, it's a tough question. And I think I'm of the opinion that I think to at least some degree it does. You know, I've had conversations. Travis is a great barometer on these things sometimes, obviously working at IGN, the biggest gaming media outlet, right? So get good perspective from him on things. And then I've worked with people or talked to people like Jez over at Windows Central, you know, and some of these sites that are kind of what you would consider these mid-level sites that still generate millions of traffic, right? And it's tough because, again, it kind of goes back to leaks are such a what's the word I'm looking for here? They're such a, not a big part of what we talk about, but they're sorry, I'm blanking on the word. So many people love to see them, right? Like the engagement for leaks is so high that if you're someone running an outlet, running a site, running a channel, oftentimes, you know, if there's a big leak like Grand Theft Auto 6 or especially something of that caliber, right? You can almost not avoid not talking about it because of just everybody's talking about it. You know what I mean? But I think to your point, there is damage there. And you can take the media or, opinion or coverage opinion of, it's what our listeners or readers or what have you want to hear and want to read and engage with. Therefore, it's our responsibility to give that to them. And that's one viewpoint, whether you agree with it or not, it's a viewpoint. And then the other viewpoint is, you know, this was not meant to be consumed by the public yet, right? There's a reason why we hadn't communicated this. Maybe it's early footage. Maybe it's early information that has since changed. You know, there's a whole bunch of factors that go in there. And then you obviously, it goes without saying, you get into the very harmful stuff of like personal information and employee data. And, you know, like we saw with Insomniac, and that's just, I think almost all of us are in agreement. That's a no-no. But yeah, to answer your question more directly, I think, yeah, it does hurt a little bit because I'm sure you felt this too, but sometimes when you're an independent creator and you're not with a big outlet, it's already more challenging at various levels, right? To get access to certain things. And then, you know, because some of our peers sometimes will be the ones who jump on leagues or jump on all this stuff from a negative connotation. It does, you know, there will be outlets that kind of go through a stiffer vetting process and to say, well, I don't really want to work with any of these smaller channels because look at what they're doing. And I definitely feel that at times. I don't know if you do, but I've definitely felt that at times.
I've definitely felt that. There have been people I know personally that have hopped on a lot of that stuff, and then I've actually even had some PR people reach out and they're like, hey, so I know you know that person and you may have talked to them a lot, but you're not doing that, right? I'm like, I'm Iceland right now. I'm doing nothing. Like I've seen some PR folks that are saying, like, when stuff like that happens, I've seen them, and especially recently, say that they're going to take note of who is covering it and not work with them. And it becomes difficult in many ways to, like, something like you said, like, not talk about the thing that everyone's talking about. But then you also have to look at how the industry is. It's very, I'm trying to put this in as delicate as a way as I can. The industry is massive, yet is very small at the same time. So the PR people and a lot of people, they all talk.
Oh yeah, it's very tight knit.
Yeah, very tight knit for the audience to understand. So you can burn a bridge one place, and then that word of that can get around, and you can be
a wildfire.
It literally is.
Yep.
And it's like you have to walk a very fine line.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of things I see, and some things I'm like, oh, maybe I should. And I'm like, yeah, no. It's not worth risking it. You know, I've seen a lot of folks at the Fall Leagues, people talking about the Insomniac Leagues and all this other stuff, and I'm just like, I'm gonna steer clear of it. I know that means less, you know, foot traffic to my website or to my channel.
Yeah.
But integrity has to count for something.
Yeah, right. Agreed. It's funny you say the word integrity. So our tagline at Season Gaming for a few years was gaming journalism with integrity for that reason. And yeah, I'm the same. Like I get invited to shows sometimes. And, you know, there have been times where I've gotten on a show and there's other guests, and immediately I see the other guests, I'm like, oh God, I shouldn't be on the show. You know what I mean? And I feel bad. Like, you know, what do I do here? And so I'm at the point now where if it's a show with a panel, not a one-on-one like this, but a panel, I usually ask who's going to be on. Because, you know, to your point, I have friends that are in PR, and I've spoken to a lot of PR, and you know, behind the scenes, people do get blacklisted, and there's groups and sites and channels that they just won't work with for reasons X, Y, and Z. And you can't blame them, you know? And so I've had moments where it's like, okay, do you want to be on the show? And okay, who's going to be on? Yeah, let's see. And, you know, they send me the list of guests. I'm like, yeah, I can't make that show. And it's like I'm sorry, like, you know, and you don't even know what to say to the host, you know. I'm just like, I can't really say why, but I can't be on that show, I'm sorry, you know. It's just the way it is. But it's tough, and but I really do wish people understood, or more people understood, that you made a great point of that. The people that talk, that run kind of the gaming media companies and the PR, it is very tight knit, and everybody talks to one another. And, you know, if to your point, if you burn a bridge and or kind of create negative content regularly and that type of thing, believe me, people are aware of it, and it's damaging. So you have to be really careful in that sense.
So I'm curious about how, like, your thoughts on this particular thing that I'm sure you've seen it too, but a lot of viewers of like content on YouTube or people who follow creators and outlets on social media, a lot of people gravitate towards the negative, mm-hmm. you know, or the controversial, because they feel like they are, and I'm using quotations, real people covering real things in a realistic way. And I see a lot of that, and I laugh because I'm like, I don't know if you watch wrestling or not, but like Eric Bischoff from WCW always says, you know, controversy creates cash. And when you're making controversial content, that doesn't mean it's as truthful as you think it is. It means that it's trending. They're going to make money off of you clicking on it. It's literally clickbait. But the reason I bring this up is because I try to be, in my reviews and coverage of stuff, as straight down the middle as possible. You know, I'm like, this is what it is. This is the overview. This is what I like about it. This is what it does great. This is where it needs to improve. This is what I don't like. Ultimately, this is my recommendation if you're into X, Y, or Z. And because I'm not someone who does a lot of negative reviews, because I've curated my coverage onto things I'm personally interested in,
yeah,
I get called a shill because I'm not being as harsh on it as I should be. But I'm like, even in my day-to-day life, I'm not really I don't know, like, what are your thoughts on that? Do you get that as well, like, if you're not as critical?
Yeah, absolutely. Or you know, you kind of get it from two angles, because you get that, to your point, where if you're complimentary about something that other people are not as complimentary on, right? I'll give you an example. So earlier this year, I reviewed Redfall, and I have a relationship with Xbox. So, you know, I get their games to review every Forza and Starfield and those games. But I reviewed Redfall, and you know, I'm very, again, I go back, very thorough. So forget the dialogue that's happening online, right? What does this game actually like? And for us, our reviews mean finish the game fully. We don't write a review unless we finish the game. Mm-hmm. And give an honest opinion of what you played and speak to it. And so I played it on PC, so I didn't have any of the 30 frame issues or the issues that a lot of the Xbox owners saw on day one. And I played the entire game. And the weird thing about Redfall is, the second that game, most people don't know, is split into two halves, and the second half of that game is better than the first half. So it doesn't do itself any favors, where the first 10 hours you're like, this is not great, you know what I mean? And it could have done things a lot better, but the second half actually has some very kind of compelling areas and things you do, and the overall message anyway. So anyway, I gave Redfall a 7, and I explained in my review why I gave it a 7, which obviously was a little higher than some sites. And you know, you get the, oh God, you're an Xbox shill, you know, Redfall's trash, haven't you seen online? And it's just like, I don't care about the people who either haven't played it or have played it for 2 hours, or, you know what I mean? It's just, it's the narrative that takes over. And then, you know, then because we cover so many things, and I love everything to death just in gaming in general, I'll get the opposite, you know. Then I will you know, say something positive about PlayStation. It's like, well, I thought you loved Xbox. It's like, I do love Xbox. Like, you can love both of them. It's okay. You know, like, or, you know, I write a review about Redfall that's, you know, not terribly negative. I mean, 7 is called honorable at Season Gaming.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh, you know, you don't like PlayStation. It's like, I promise you, I have played and owned more things with PlayStation than you probably ever will. Trust me. Like, you know, it's, so anyway, it is funny. It's like, I think honestly, what me and Hoag and some of the guys have joked about is like, if you're getting it from both sides, you're probably doing it right. Because, you know, honestly, if the Xbox guys are mad, you're talking about PlayStation positively, and the PlayStation guys are mad, you're talking about Xbox positively, and Nintendo, you know, kind of does their own thing, but they're over here. And if you get in all of that, you're probably pretty balanced. You're probably somewhere in the middle.
I know one game I covered, and I know this game got destroyed, but Babylon's Fall. I enjoyed it, but I also looked at it differently than other reviewers, because when I played it, I was like, wait, those are MMO mechanics. Because I played a lot of Final Fantasy 14. Like, that was, I'd say, the most recent MMO that I have really, like, sunk the most time into. In fact, like, my youngest daughter is named after one main characters from the expansion.
Nice.
You know, because, like, my wife and I were both, like, super obsessed with that game. But a lot of Final Fantasy 14 mechanics were in Babylon's Fall. And, like, when I was explaining that in my review, I constantly got people saying, oh, your show, you know, Square Enix paid you to do this review because all these other people are passionate on it. I'm like, when I played the game to completion, I actually got past the super jank part.
Yep.
Do you guys? Yep. Like, oh, I didn't play the game, but my favorite reviewer.
Yep. You see that a lot.
Yeah, like, the thing that's really funny to me that's, and maybe it's a generational thing too, is I feel like when we were coming up, gaming, if you could play a game, if you can get your hands on a game, because it was so expensive back in the day, like, you would play it. Even if it was crap, you would play
Oh, yeah. That's the game you were playing.
Exactly. But now it's like, you have people that, I like to say, partake in voyeurism in a way, because, like, they'd rather someone either play it for them and form their opinion so that they can form their opinion off of someone else's opinion, or just, you know, oh, general consensus said this is trash, so I'm not going to play it. It's weird how less likely a lot of people are now are to just pick up a game and play it than before. And it's like, there's so many things out. You've got Game Pass. I know a lot of people say, that's not good for the industry. It's actually great because now you can get an Xbox and, you know, play whatever you want that they have on it. Enjoy that. I mean, there are other streaming services out there. PlayStation's catching up with that with their PlayStation. But it's like, there's so many ways to consume, and people are, for the most part, not willing to try something outside of something they know, or a YouTuber or someone that they follow, they need them to validate. And it's weird.
It is weird.
I don't know if I'm making sense. But
no, yeah, you 100% are. It ties back to, like, when we were talking about the negatives of the modern day industry, right? We're I said earlier, we're spoiled for choice. I think it's because back then it was so rare to get a new game, to your point, for most people anyway, I would say, right? And games came out so less frequently that when a new game came out, you played it. You know, I vividly remember I loved Alex Kidd, the original Miracle World on Sega Master System.
Man.
And going back. And my mom didn't have much money, and a new Alex Kidd game came out. And back then, you didn't have reviews on social media or YouTube when a game came out. A game just came out. You saw it in the store. It had Alex Kidd on it. And I remember my mom buying it for me for my birthday, which was a lot of money for her because they were still like $50 at the time, which back then, you know, is like $120 now, I think, with inflation. And I took it home that night. She let me play it. I played it and I beat it that night in like 45 minutes. I mean, I just ran through it. And credits are on, and she's like, you've beaten that game already. And I remember her saying it, and she's English. I can't do an English accent. but I said, yeah, and it didn't matter that I beat it. You just kept playing it. You know, you just kept playing it over and over, because that was my one new game that I was going to have for probably a few months. You know, it's just the way it was. And I think now it's really sad to see that, to your point, someone on social media, someone on YouTube, a reviewer, whoever it may be, that influences another person, and say, oh, I didn't really like it, it's not a very good game, or they immediately go into the pure derogatory, it's trash, right? And they'll never touch it. And it's just like, that could be your favorite game and you don't even realize it, you know? Give games a chance. There's so many games today, and the ones that are truly like ones or twos that are like broken, terrible games, you probably haven't heard about them anyway. The mainstream games, you know, that are the anywhere from fives to sevens on the review scale, those are generally pretty good games. And there's probably some gems in there that you're missing just because you refuse to give it an actual shot.
Definitely. A few other things before we wrap up. Sure. I want to ask you, what are your thoughts on how indie gaming has, where it is now in comparison to where, like, we saw the, because I like to tie into like the retro boom of the mid 2000s. A lot of games like going for that retro aesthetic. And then we started seeing indie companies in the 2010s come out with like bangers, Shovel Knight and such. And like now it's at a point we have indie games like Chained Echoes, Bomb Rush, Cyberpunk, you know, Sea of Stars and more that you can't like the idea of indie game being not as good as AAA is kind of completely out of the window now.
Yes.
You know, and it's like, and I feel like, you know, with indie developers, they have a lot of the passion to make these amazing games without a lot of the corporate, you know, oh, it's got to have this, got to do this, you know, a microtransaction. It's been really good seeing them grow and become what they are now, as well as the narrative, oh, it's an indie game, from like a kind of like a sneak diss to now it's like, oh man, this game is great.
Yeah, it's completely different, to your point. It's been great to see. I think the, again, it's funny we keep coming back to the original of how the industry has changed from when we were younger to now, because the access to not only content create as we're doing as we speak, right, but also actually create in the gaming space has vastly changed. You know, there was a time where you had to have specific development kits, hardware that was shipped to you that you had to be a company to get. They cost, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars per unit. And therefore, game development was limited to specific companies that could afford to develop. And, you know, for the most part, obviously, there's some smaller examples counter to that in the past. But now you have things like, you know, you can literally go in and work with Unity, or you can work with Unreal Engine and self-teach. I mean, there's every instructional video you can ever find on how to learn how to program games. And because of that, it has truly evolved the industry with independent games, to your point, of just the vast quality we've seen in the last, what do you think, maybe 10 to 15 years, the increase in quality in independent games is monumental. You know, things like, you look at something like, maybe it's not as small now, but Hollow Knight Silksong is like one of the most anticipated games in the industry right now. You look at Vampire Survivors last year, right? That just took off. One developer of just this single plane 2D game, and it became one of the most popular games of the year, winning awards and millions of copies. And I love it, man. I think it's amazing. And I think what I like to see out of independent games is, to your point, which I agree with, is they are not bound by certain restrictions that some of the AAA studios are, whether it be their parent companies or funding or whatever it may be. So you see creativity in a lot of areas that you don't see necessarily in some of the AAA space. And I think that having that capability for us as consumers to just see all these games and be able to consume them, you know, as we said, anytime on almost any platform, it's just wild. It's absolutely wild, because no matter what genre you like, no matter what mechanics you like or art style, you know, any type of game you like, there's probably dozens of games you could go buy right now and play immediately that are in that vein. And that's, I don't think we ever envisioned that when we were younger.
No. And adding to that, what are your thoughts on AAA companies remastering, remaking, and re-releasing their titles?
Yeah.
Like, do you feel that it's due to a lack of creativity, or they just need a quick turnaround?
More of the latter, probably. I mean, the fact of the matter is companies make money. They are influenced by what makes money, and generally speaking, I think what we've seen proven through the last, however, again, maybe 15, 20 years, is that remasters can make money pretty quickly with small, much smaller groups than you need for a new AAA IP, right? I'm not opposed to them. I think unlike the movie space or the music space, right, games are very different in the sense that the technology truly changes them fundamentally in some ways. And so, you know, you look at, you know, the big one this year, right, Resident Evil 4 Remake. Or you look at something like Demon's Souls, right? So the originating game kind of in that vein from Software that has started almost a revolution in the industry in terms of Souls-likes. Being able now to play that on your PS5 and an absolutely stunning, gorgeous rendition of that game is excellent. I love that. But I definitely feel that that is more of the case that's way out here is kind of what I would put on the pedestal is that's a perfect remake, right? That's something that's great to see. Foundational game. It had been however many years, 15, 20 years, and it's truly transformative when you play it now. Versus, you know, it's the easy one to point to right now, but The Last of Us 2 remaster, right? It's just like that game came out 3 years ago and is playable in beautiful 60 frames on your PS5 today. Why are we remastering that? I mean, that feels a little disingenuous, you know, to a degree. You know, I hope people enjoy it. I hope if you love it, again, I would never kind of talk negatively to people playing it, but it just feels like, you know, those are your two kind of examples where it's like, you know, some remakes and remasters I think make a lot of sense. And then others, it just feels like pure kind of cash grab.
Yeah. And all right, I have two more questions.
No, you're good, man. I'm good. Enjoying the conversation. It's fun.
So the Game Awards this year.
Yes.
All the people had to say about that. Is it a net positive for gaming as a whole, or do you think it was trying too hard to win over investors and people who aren't into gaming?
Yeah. I think it's a little bit of both, if I'm honest. I think people... Maybe this is anecdotal, and maybe it's just what we see in our space, right? But I think people can be a little harsh on Keighley to a degree in the sense of, you know, you do have to, well, nobody does. I do. I credit him with at least creating a show that does bring kind of global attention to gaming. It is on a level that if when we were kids, or again, going back to when we were younger, hell, even 15, 20 years ago, I don't think any of us ever envisioned we would have gaming on a kind of global stage like the Oscars or Emmys or what have you, right? So I think you credit him for that, and that's not an easy thing to do. I can only imagine the work that goes into putting a show like that together. But at the same time, I think that his direction with it is misguided a little bit, maybe is the right word. It feels like he's trying to, maybe I'll say it this way, by trying to validate video games on the level of movies and music and other industries, I think he's actually harming the show. Because video games don't need to stand upon a platform alongside movies or music or anything else for that matter. Video games can stand by themselves. Yeah. And I think that he would behoove not only the show, but all of us as gamers, if you will, if he focused more on that. And, you know, instead of, you don't, I don't, Timothy Chalamet, you're great, dude. You're Dune. I loved it. You're cool. You seem like a nice guy. I don't need you on my gaming show. I just don't, you know, go be Wonka, go do your movie. You know, you're great. Dune 2, I'll be there day one. I'm looking forward to it, but I don't need you presenting an award, right? You don't matter to me in this space. Yeah. Have Sean Layden come out, have a direct, you know, give the director of Baldur's Gate 3 more time to speak, for God's sakes. You know, all the things that kind of like that. There's so many voices and so many incredible talents in the gaming industry, from leadership all the way down to content creators, to accessibility experts, to, you know, all these different things that we could be celebrating. That I think would be better served on a stage like that. So stop trying to make it Hollywood. You can still make it a big show, right? It can still get tens and millions of viewers, but celebrate gaming at its core more. And I think it has done a poor job of that the past couple of years.
Yeah.
That's what I would say.
I fully agree about that. do you think that losing E3... Mm-hmm. and pretty much having Game Awards and Summer Games Fest be I mean, they're not the only game in town when it comes to platforms, but like,
yeah,
they're the biggest outside of what's the other one? I'm trying to think of the
You have PAX, you have
I got a bone to pick with them because every time I talk to them, they're like, yeah, you know, I always get denied for it. I'm like, I've been to E3 multiple times. Like,
yeah, that's weird.
Yeah, every time I apply, they're like, nah, you're not coming. Anyway, but like, you know, as far as like losing E3, because E3, and I know a lot of people say, well, E3 wasn't anything special. It's funny because the 90s and 2000s and 2010s, that was the big event. That was the big thing. And I've always said this to people who have not gone to it. Like people are like, oh, I watched E3 on YouTube, or, you know, my favorite YouTuber recapped it. That doesn't take away from the experience of being there.
Yep.
But I feel like E3 not being a thing anymore, or maybe temporarily, I don't know. We'll see. Basically, Keeley doesn't have anyone to tell him or really like showcase that an alternative would be better.
Yeah.
I think we need something like an E3 to come back, or something on that level to, you know, give him some competition.
I completely agree with you. Yeah, I completely agree. Summer Game Fest, in my opinion, is a mess, because all Summer Game Fest really is, right? You have its dedicated show, which isn't really that great of a show. And then it kind of pulls in all these other events from independent publishers and developers and Twitch and, you know, all these different things. And it's disjointed, and it's just kind of a mess.
Yeah.
And the great thing about E3 was that it pulled everyone together. It was I feel like we keep going back to what I said to start, but going back to the kind of gaming camaraderie, right? It was the 5 days or so. It was that weekend where the gaming industry and kind of everyone who covered it, the media organizations, the people who worked in it, the developers and content creators at the time would all just come together. And it was like, this week it's gaming time, and this is what we're doing. And the showcases were born out of that, right? And obviously, I think we all fondly remember some of the most, biggest spectacles in gaming were those showcases over the years. But even beyond that, and people say, well, they can just, you know, Xbox or PlayStation or whoever, Nintendo can just do their directly on YouTube, and they still get tens of millions of views, and it's fine. It's the same thing. And it's like, it's the same thing in terms of maybe viewership. It's not the same thing overall. Yeah. And I get why they do it. It saves them money. It's much easier. I get it, right? I always get the business side of it, but there's absolutely something to be said for all of those different talents and people and cultures and everything going back to just gaming coming together in a location for 3 to 5 days. And what was born out of that was more relationships, development talent, you know, things that would go into amazing content creation, just partnerships. You know, there's a lot of kind of unspoken things that would occur, and we have lost that. And I really hope that someone somewhere, whoever it is, figures out a way for that to come back in some form better than it is now, because the whole just, well, wait for whenever PlayStation wants to do a state of play, as we sit here twiddling our thumbs forever, and then it shows up on a random, you know, random Tuesday in October. It's not the same. It's just not. I completely agree with you. I do miss it. I went in 18 and 19, had an absolutely fantastic time. In fact, in 18, we couldn't get media for SG. And in 19, we did. And that was a big reason for us to celebrate. We got recognized as media for E3. And we just had a fantastic time. And I was really looking forward to 2020. We had huge plans for it. And then COVID hit, obviously. And it was canceled. And since then, of course, it's been a shame to see what's happened to it. But no, I agree with you. I'm hopeful that somewhere along the way, there's a happy medium between old E3, which was a trade show originally, right, which we don't really need today, versus all of these just random broadcasts that happen at sporadic times. I'm hoping there's a happy medium where we can say, hey, we still need the gaming community to just come together for a few days. And you know, that should be at X time somewhere.
Yeah.
That'd be cool.
Yeah, I have to say, I definitely want that to happen again, because these Nintendo Directs at okay, for those of y'all who don't know, I'm here in Hawaii. So when a Nintendo Directs hit, sometimes even the PlayStation their thing, it's usually 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning here, and I'm like, I'm sorry, I am not about to get up to cover that. And I know I'm missing traffic by not doing that, but it's like these hours just don't make sense. Whereas like something like E3, it made sense going to that, you know? And it's definitely interesting seeing how the void left by E3 has not been filled. I don't care. No. Summer Games Fest is not. No, it's not.
Yeah, it's not even close. No, I would say that Gamescom is probably the closest we have in terms of a general show where everyone comes together. And Gamescom is massive. I mean, hundreds of thousands of people go to it. But I don't think the industry itself treats it, you know, like E3 was, right? So you don't get the same type of coverage or announcements or that type of thing. You get some, but not to the same level. And so, yeah, I don't know. I don't know what the future is there, but I'm with you. I have fingers crossed that something kind of rises from the ashes.
All right. So I actually do have a couple more questions. I'm enjoying the conversation. I'm like, I got to ask you this. So sure. With how stacked this year has been.
Yeah.
What have been some of your favorite games or your game of the year?
Wow. Yeah. It's funny. My favorite game of 2023 is still Diablo 4. I am a hardcore Diablo player, have been since one in the 90s, and I was super excited about Diablo 4. I've reviewed it, so I got early access to it, and I think in the first month between my review and continuing to play, I put like 300 hours in the first month. I mean, just ridiculous. I was up every night playing it. So I think that's still my favorite game. I think it's tremendous, and it will only get better, right? It'll just continue to evolve. That said, I have not, going back to what we said earlier, I haven't finished a bunch of games that came out this year that I know friends and peers and stuff have as their game of the year. So I've played about 20 to 25 hours of Baldur's Gate 3, which is like nothing from what I hear of that game, right? So I want to play more of that, really enjoying it. I've got about 10 to 12 hours into Alan Wake 2. So I'm not even like halfway through that, because I play games very slowly. So I want to play that. I really enjoy it. I'm sure there's some others I'm gonna forget. I am a big car racing guy, like I said, so I reviewed Forza Motorsport. I enjoyed that. It's got some shortcomings, I think, that, you know, I'm hoping they work on over time, and they are. Mm-hmm. But I still really put a lot of time into that too. And then I still live a lot in the competitive shooter space, so I play a ton of Halo. On top of that, I play Apex Legends, I play PUBG, I play Warzone, and now I'm playing The Finals, which is one of my favorite releases of the year, too. So I play a lot of games that get content updates, just live service games. So they take a lot of my time. I don't want to know how much time I have in Halo this year, but it's a lot. It's a lot. So, you know, in terms of new games, I would say Diablo 4 is probably still the tops. In the shooter space, The Finals, if you're not aware of what this game is, I was in the alpha for it. They debuted it last year, I think, at the Game Awards, funny enough.
Yeah.
And it's a competitive shooter with destruction. It's from ex-Battlefield devs. And they've really focused on the destruction aspect, but it takes place, it's got kind of a funny sense of humor. It takes place as you're on a game show in the future. I loved it in the alpha and beta. I did a video on it. And then at this year's Game Awards, they surprise dropped it. You know, they surprise launched it. And I was ecstatic over that. So I've been playing that a ton over the past 2 weeks.
All right.
How about yourself? What's your game of the year right now?
That's hard.
It well, is hard. It, I mean, there's endless options almost.
So I love Exoprimal.
Okay, like, nice.
That's been one of my favorite games. Like I played from the original closed beta or closed alpha, then the betas, and then got the game, reviewed it, got to do you know, Capcom's Twitch to stream the new updates.
That's awesome.
I love that game. It's so funny that a lot of people are mad because it's not Dino Crisis, and I'm like, they never marketed it.
Nothing like Dino Crisis.
So Exoprimal for me is up there. Hogwarts Legacy, I know there's all the controversy around that. And
oh, I loved Hogwarts, fantastic game.
It really was. Like, and I'm not even a Harry Potter fan. Like my wife
and I
were it and just loved it. And it's crazy because I asked her a lot of questions because she's a massive Harry Potter fan. I'm like, yeah, okay. I don't understand this, but you know, this is really cool. I thought that game was really cool.
I
love that. You know, of course, Dead Space remake, Resident Evil 4 remake. Final Fantasy 16, as much as I did not enjoy going to LA for that. And I can say with certainty I did upset Square Enix because like I was like, yeah, I didn't have a great time there. I didn't get to play the game. Dude, I spent
What?
Yeah, okay, bro. All these other creators that went to that event were flown there from all over the world. I literally like last minute got invited, had to get my own place, own ticket, spent over a grand to go there, didn't get to play it.
That's wild.
Yeah.
How do they have a game event where you don't play the game?
They're like, oh, well, you have to have this thing. I'm like, I'm an invited guest. I don't get to play it. I never got to play it. So I complained, I filed a complaint to them. They gave me a review copy of the game. And since I filed my complaint, bro, they've not worked with me since. I'm like, okay, whatever. But Final Fantasy 16, I enjoyed that a lot.
Crazy. I'm sad to hear that, man. That's disappointing. Yeah, if for those listening who may not be aware, if you get invited as a creator to an event for a game or a publisher or something like that, there's an absolute 100% expectation that you're going to play that game or play their games at the event, especially if you're footing your own bill. That is absolutely crazy, because otherwise, why would a creator go? Because the whole point of going is so that you can create coverage for your audience from that event. So if you don't get to play the game, what are you even covering? That's crazy, man. I'm sorry to hear that. I don't think I've ever heard a story like that before.
No, it was so wild. I'm like, really? And then when I was talking to the PR people there, I was like, hey, can I play the game? Oh, you need to go talk to this person. Go talk to that person. Go talk to that person. Oh, go talk to him. But they just sent me to you. Mm. And like, I think that was the first time I've ever seen. Careful with how I'm saying this too. That was the first time I've ever publicly seen how clickish it can be sometimes, like some of the PR people with some of the creators, because the ones who they all like, certain folks there always like retweet and reshare. They're the only ones that really got to do anything to that event, and they're also the ones that were flown there. And I didn't get to meet Yoshi P, didn't get to talk to the voice. I didn't get anything there, and I'm like, bro, I spent grand to go here.
That's crazy.
That was one of the worst events, and it sucks that they don't, like, I get denied for anything now from that. Weird. I'm like, really? Because I complain? Okay, whatever. But it is what it is. Final Fantasy 16, I enjoyed that. Story really got me. And that... I would say my game of the year is probably going to be Hogwarts Legacy, just because it was so immersive.
Awesome.
And it doesn't like, not that I don't like Harry Potter. I never got to get into it as a kid because my mom was like, oh, that's witchcraft. She's super rich.
Like, I've got friends like that, yeah.
Anything with like magic or demons or anything back then. I didn't get, well, I would still like watch her play his stuff with when she wasn't around, but like she was weird about that. But yeah, that was my game of the year, and it sucks it didn't get any Game Awards nomination.
Yeah. He basically got ignored all award season. And yeah, I don't know if you saw, I posted about that, and I said, look, I get the issues, right, with the IP and the owner of the IP. I get it. But it's kind of a shame that several hundred developers who created this awesome game aren't getting any recognition at all, you know? And Jesus, did that blow up? Yeah. I thought I was making a pretty clear, definitive statement and people who follow me know, like, I mean, obviously, like, you know, certainly not supportive of anything, you know, she has said or anything. It's ridiculous, right? I think that should be clear. If you follow me, you know the type of person I am. But man, that blew up to like millions and millions and millions of views and people unfollowing me and saying I hate, you know, people. And I'm like, good God, all I said was these developers deserve some recognition for making a great game. I mean, that's it. The developers themselves have come out against, can't even think of her damn name. But you know what I'm saying. J.K. Rowling, like, you know, that her commentary and stuff is hateful and, you know, all those things. And developers themselves have said that. It's like the developers of the game are not her, you know what I mean? Like, yes, she created the IP, but I mean, come on, the IP itself is well beyond her at this point in time. I think it's a shame when we kind of get some people, I guess, get laser focused on that kind of stuff.
It was unfortunate too, because I feel like there was a time where, like, when that came out, it was you really took a risk covering it. Because you remember,
there was the thing, reviewed it. Yeah.
How much hate did you get for it?
Mine wasn't too bad. I think, again, because I curate, you know, my audience is so curated and people know me well enough to know, you know, the type of person I am. But Travis reviewed it for IGN, and it's their most viewed review, I think, of all time. It's something like 400 million views. Yeah. It's like something absurd for IGN, right? And yeah, he got a lot of negative messages about just reviewing the game. And it's, you know, if you know Travis, he's like, for God's sakes, he lives in San Francisco. Like, he's the like most progressive guy you would know. And it's just like, yeah, I guess it just comes with the territory. It's disappointing, but yeah. It's a shame. Because it really is a magical game. I never got into Harry Potter. I think I was a little old for it. It kind of came just after I was, you know, I was already in my 20s. But the way they recreated kind of Hogwarts as a castle and an environment and kind of just the mysticism and magic of it was incredibly well done.
So So the absolute last question is what are your thoughts on the current console war? Comparison to when we grew up.
Yeah. It's very strange. I think I've been talking about this again, going back to kind of how I gained an audience here, is talking about tech and understanding where cloud architecture is going and, you know, all these things that go into the modern gaming. It's kind of where I work in my career. So I have a good understanding of it all. And I've been fortunate enough, you know, to talk to people at Xbox, like senior leadership and, you know, people like Jason Ronald, right, who designed the Xbox Series X hardware. And so, you know, with that context, I had honestly been looking at the direction of PlayStation, Xbox, and Nintendo as almost three pillars. Because Nintendo is, I think we all kind of agree, is kind of more the classic model, right? They sell their Switch. It's mostly a walled garden. Their software retains its value ridiculously. And, you know, Nintendo just finds a way to be profitable doing what they do. Now, they're slowly evolving, but they're well, you know, behind everyone else. Xbox, I would say, was on the other end of the spectrum, where they knew from a hardware sales perspective, they were in a distant third globally, distant third. And so they started to take advantage of their technology with Microsoft to build this kind of future where of connectivity, Game Pass, PC and Xbox working together, same day, cross-play, cross-progression, you know, all these kind of features which really make gaming, in my opinion, a very nice place to be in 2023 if you're in that environment, right? Mm-hmm. And then PlayStation was kind of this mix of in between. You know, they globally, the PlayStation brand is ridiculous, the weight it carries. They sell consoles like, you know, hotcakes. Their IP strength is tremendous, and they know that they take advantage of that, rightfully so as a business. But they also know that they've got to start playing in the tech space more. So they've evolved PS Plus right into the tiers, and they've got the they've done a good job with their not cloud gaming, but their remote play. So they've kind of dabbled. You know, their app has been updated. So I give you that context to say, when you say console war, you know, there was a time when you think about the old Genesis and Super Nintendo days, the models were extremely similar because that's all that the market was at the time. You bought a console, you bought box games in a store, and that's all there was. And so you competed on that front. Nowadays, it's so much different because it's not necessarily about one thing. It's not console sales. It's not necessarily software sales because you have live service, right? So the metrics around that are more around engagement and just total spend. You know, how many players you have and what are they spending in your ecosystem. And I've written a ton about that. I've done a lot of videos on it. And I really, that's where the geek in me really comes out, the kind of mathematics guy, because I love diving into those details. And so I don't know. I think that, you know, it's obviously changed now with Microsoft's acquisition of Bethesda and now Activision Blizzard. I mean, that just shakes up the whole kind of equation. But I think that I really like what all three companies are doing, in that they're a little bit unique in each of them. And I enjoy each of them for different reasons. I play on PC, but I play mainly on Xbox and PlayStation as a console. Nintendo, not as much nowadays. But I don't know, the console war. Sorry, that was long-winded, but just giving you kind of, but the console war, right? I think is really, it's weird because it's such a big business thing now between PlayStation and Xbox, primarily between Sony and Microsoft. And you know, Microsoft is obviously flexing its financial muscle and tech muscle, I think, over the past 5 years in particular, to really, you know, kind of change the game. Where that goes from here, we'll see. But I do think, even if you're one of those guys who just lives on Xbox and you see what they've done with Bethesda and ABK and all everything they've done, which is, you know, I'm generally a fan of, I think there is an underestimation of PlayStation's brand strength globally, because they are everywhere. And I don't think, especially in America, some people realize how strong PlayStation is elsewhere. You know, they are the video game console, period. And PlayStation needs to figure out how to evolve that into a more into a non-console only mentality, which they are. And I think, you know, they are, they're just a little slower. So sorry, that's a bit all over the place, but the console war to me is kind of meaningless. I like looking at them as separate companies that are doing unique things and evaluating how they're doing those things. You know, I'll always support them both, or if there's, you know, three or four, whoever, I'll always support them all.
It's interesting at this point because, you know, when people, I've been in conversations with people talk about the current console war, I tell them at this point, it's really a matter of what piece of plastic do you pick up? Do you pick up a PlayStation controller? Do you pick up a Nintendo Switch controller? Do you pick up an Xbox controller? Like, it's literally that. It's not.
Is that the Halo one?
Yes, the Halo.
Yeah, you know, I recognized it right away. Heck yeah.
You know, like, it's not the way it used to be where you got a game on the Genesis, it was substantially different than it was in the Super Nintendo, or the NES game.
Like
was
Mortal Kombat.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, like, we're not in that time frame anymore.
No, and just play where you want to play.
Exactly. And it's interesting when I hear some people say that, you know, Xbox and Microsoft are anti-consumer because of, you know, Game Pass and their business model and everything like that. So I used to work for Microsoft at one point, And it's interesting seeing like the Game Pass topic that was coming up back in like the, it was thrown around a bit around before the Xbox One came out. And so I remember, or not really what I remember, where I'm going with that is, actually, no, where I do remember, we look at Microsoft as a company. We look at how, and this might be an extreme example, right? But remember how Office used to be fundamentally different on Mac than it was for the young folks there. You don't know that. It used to be way different on Mac than it was on PC. And you had a lot of stripped down functionality on Mac, which is one of the main reasons that they were pushing, you know, there was the Pages and Keynote and all the other stuff. Mm-hmm. As time went on, Microsoft's like, all right, why don't we just put our services on everything?
Yep.
And just charge a subscription model. What do you think Game Pass is? It's the same concept. And it just gives you, like, do they care if you buy the Xbox or not? On some level, I think they do, but the fact that you're playing their games on however you play it, remote play, cloud, or you know, on the hardware, on PC, you got choice, and they're breaking it all in.
That's literally all that matters.
You know, and Nintendo can continue to get away with the physical hardware because that's their thing. You know, and a lot of people don't realize that Nintendo was a toy company. At the heart, why do you think there's so many friggin' amiibos? Yes, I have right here. But, you know, it's really interesting looking at how the console war isn't really the console war. It's just, what do you want to play on?
Yeah. Yeah. It's always going to be about money. You know, people will dance around that and they'll talk about other things. And to your exact point of Microsoft doesn't care, or Xbox, however you want to say it, doesn't really care where you're playing because you're engaging. It goes back to engagement and money, and money will always dictate direction for the corporation. It's that simple. And if they can, people have asked, you know, more recently around Game Pass on Switch or Game Pass on PlayStation in the future. And I wrote an article about Game Pass on Switch like 4 years ago, 5 years ago. And I was trying to tell people then, like, I know it may seem like, you know, this is crazy talk and it'll never happen, but it might happen. You know, if it comes a time where Xbox feels it is profitable to put Game Pass on the Switch and they can come to an agreement with Nintendo on whatever that revenue sharing split is, right? And they don't feel, based on all, you know, truckloads of people, as you know, doing calculations on spreadsheets to say how this will potentially damage the Xbox brand or Microsoft brand and how much that'll cost the company. After all those calculations are done, if it is profitable, it'll happen. Mm-hmm. And that's just a simple fact of the matter. That's how companies operate. So I think that the mentality of, you know, you have a walled garden here, you have a walled garden here, and you play in your camp and they play in their camp, it's so outdated and antiquated. It's just a silly way to think and tell people, because we get a lot of people in the season gaming community that are new to games, especially since merging kind of with Hoag on BitCast, because a lot of his audience came from legal cases, not necessarily gamers. And so there's been a lot of people that have talked to us about, like, if we were to start in gaming, where would we start? And, you know, it's a weird question nowadays because it's like, well, where would you prefer to play? Do you prefer sitting in a PC? Do you want to sit on the TV on the couch? And, you know, then let's say they say couch, it's like, well, Xbox or PlayStation. It's like either one, you know, you're going to love. You can play 98% of the same games for this at the same, like you said, the same kind of fidelity and same type of game. You know, there's so little difference in that space now. And the, you know, the arguments over certain exclusives, it's kind of silly because they're still there, but they on the mass market, they hold such little weight in the conversation about revenue and everything else that goes into gaming today. It's kind of fascinating how much it's changed, like everything else we've talked about, honestly. So just play where you want to play, enjoy what you want to play. My thing has always been, look, what game do I want to play? I'll just play it. If there is a substantial difference, maybe Redfall is a good example where it played far better on PC, I'll play it on PC. But otherwise, I just play wherever I'm comfortable.
And with that being said, is there anything you want to leave the audience with before we go?
No, not really. I think first I'll say thank you. Fun conversation. I like that we went longer. As you can tell, I love talking about games, or I hope you can tell. I love talking about games. I love talking about their history. And when I get in the room with someone like yourself who shares a lot of the same history and timeline with games, we could talk forever, I'm sure, about you know, things. So I'll have to have you. We don't do guests a lot on BigCast nowadays, just because we're a set four, but we have talked about kind of getting back to that. I think our audience likes when we have a guest or someone new that comes in, so I'll have to have you on for sure. Next year we'll do it. And other than that, I would just say, yeah, check out Season Gaming. You know, we do a lot of coverage nowadays, so there is news and stuff. News is a little less nowadays because, you know, quick hits are much more social media focused than a site than they used to be. But we do a ton of reviews. We do good opinion articles. We have a weekly live show. And it's just we have a lot of fun over there. It's very genuine is what I would say. So, yeah, check that out if you like gaming coverage. So that's about it. And you can find me. Ainsley is a unique name. There's not many of us. So you can find me under Ains on Twitter, on Threads, on, you know, wherever you hang out.
Awesome. And I actually have a final question.
Sure, sure, sure.
What's your opinion on people saying that Ocarina of Time was not a massive thing in 98?
They're idiots. Stop it. Stop it. Who says that? The only people who say that are people who either weren't alive or were younger than four in 1998. Because if you were an adult in 1998 and knew anything about gaming at all, Ocarina of Time was a game changer. I'm not even a Zelda fan. Like I rather famously joking, I joke about Zelda a lot because I'm not a huge Zelda guy. Even growing up with the original Zelda on the NES and everything, it's just not one that speaks to me personally. And to say Ocarina of Time wasn't a big thing in 98, you're out of your damn mind. That game was industry changing. It was industry changing, that game. Come on, stop it. I mean, who says that? I haven't even heard that. That took me completely off guard because I haven't heard something that stupid in a while.
I've seen some posts like that. They get some traction, and I'm just thinking, you could not have been around.
No, like, absolutely not. No way. No way.
Like, that was
good. God, man.
It's a game. Like when the 64 came out and they said, oh, we're gonna make Zelda, people like, what? And then they started showing the trailers and all the articles in the magazines. I'm like, that's one thing I can't stand is the revisionism in gaming now.
No, it's kidding.
Like okay. Saying, oh, Xbox has never been popular. Were you around for the original Xbox? Were you there for the 360 era? They were dominating.
Yeah. They changed gaming. That's another thing that gets me. What has Xbox ever done for the gaming industry? Have you been paying attention? Like, what are you even looking at? Like, they like the amount of things that they did first in the gaming industry, you know, it's been crazy. And each of the companies deserves credit in different ways, right? They each did something special for gaming. But, yeah, there's weird things, you know. Like that come up. Ocarina of Time was not big enough. Good God, dude. That's like I had someone debate with me recently on Mario 64, because I said Mario 64 was absolutely foundational for 3D gaming. Like it changed the concept of what gaming could be when the Nintendo 64 launched and you first played Mario 64. And I forget who was challenging me that. I'm not even going to talk to you about this. This isn't worth a conversation. You know, because there it's just a fact, you know. I mean, between Mario 64 and Ocarina of Time, Nintendo, those two games alone kind of changed the concept of what 3D games could be. Yeah. And you know, PlayStation gets a lot of credit, rightfully so, for 3D early 3D gaming. And kind of changing the perspective of things. And, you know, but to say Mario 64 or Ocarina of Time weren't absolutely revolutionary is a joke. Absolutely they were. Yeah, I mean, there's no debate about that. I don't know. I don't know. You got me going on a rant now, you know. It's just, oh, God. Oh, and that's, man. To your point, I think that's one of the other things too. It's like one of the most annoying habits I see in modern discourse, or lack of discourse, is if someone doesn't like something, they try to downplay it or find poke holes in it, you know, downplay its significance, that type of thing. And it's like, you can do both. Like I said, I'm not a huge Zelda fan. That does, I absolutely recognize Zelda as one of the most iconic franchises in gaming, and it has literally dictated the shape of certain genres of games for 40 years. Like, mm-hmm. that's just a fact. There shouldn't be any debate. It doesn't matter if I like it or not. It doesn't matter. The fact is the fact. I mean, how many game directors have attributed Zelda for how they've thought about their game? I'm a From Software, you know, Souls fanatic. I love Souls games. Elden Ring, I'm playing it again right now. It's probably, if not my favorite game of all time, it's top three up there with Witcher 3 and maybe a couple others. But even Miyazaki, right, From CEO and the designer of the From games, even him attributed Zelda and Breath of the Wild and some of those things to some of their design concepts. You know, it's just Zelda has influenced games for decades. It's crazy to try and downplay Zelda. Sorry, that was a much longer answer than you wanted, but there you go.
No, that was perfect. I was wondering how you react to that, because like every time I see, and I see a lot of people say that about Mario 64 was not good and didn't change 3D game. I'm like, what are you talking about?
It defined it. You know what I mean? It literally created it for the most part. I mean, there were concepts of 3D gaming games hadn't really dabbled with or even attempted to do until Mario 64. Yeah, it's revolutionary.
I'm like, do you want Bubsy 3D to be the
See, that's the alternate timeline we didn't want. Luckily, we got Mario, you know, 64 that took us this way.
Oh, man. Okay. So, again, man, thank you for coming on the show. It's been
absolutely.
We got to have you on the show again, man.
Yeah, man, anytime. It's fun chat for sure. And like I said, I'll hit you up in the new year. We'll get you on Big Cast for sure to chat with us.
Definitely. And thank you guys. Whether you're listening to us on your favorite podcasting outlet or you're watching it on YouTube, thank you so much for spending time with us today out of your busy days. Hope you guys have a happy holiday. Links to everything for our guests is going to be in the description down below. So make sure you stalk them on everything. Stalk in a good way. Like, support, follow, all that stuff. Don't do any other stuff. But all that being said, I hope you have an aloha rest of your day, and we'll see you guys on the next one. And that was all for your time for listening to this episode of the Casanova Podcast, and more podcasts in Hawaii. If you found this episode to be incredibly enjoyable, informative, or if there's anything you gain from it, or any insight, or you know, anything that's good that you really, really enjoy, make sure whatever platform you're listening to it on, or if you're watching it, leave a comment if that's available on the platform, like it, share it around with someone you think would enjoy it, and give us some feedback, because your feedback is exactly what we need to keep this show going. And if you're wondering what are some ways that you could support the show, we got various ways. We've got Patreon, we have channel memberships over on YouTube, as well as Subscribestar, Coffee, and so much more. Links for everything will be in the description of the podcast, so make sure you go check that out. And with all that being said, I hope you have an aloha rest of your day.
Let them know that I'm next level, I'm a whole new kind of guy. Is at the top spot in case you forgot. We the ones that got the block hot, bullet got the shot. Yeah.